source is Guelph here on CFRU 93.3
FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Did I just come on?
Is this mic hot? It's so hot. I'm feeling the fury and flames of this mic right here.
Like I said, this is Open Sources Guelph. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz on the switch, and the caffeine hasn't kicked in yet. But give me 30.1 seconds.
The caffeine hasn't clicked in at 5 p.m.
Yes. That's how I roll, brother.
Open Sources and CFRU's Political and Current Affairs Discussion Show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today we will look at the situation in Syria. A member of a three-person panel investigating human rights abuses in that country has resigned, saying, and I quote, "Everyone in Syria is bad now." Is she just being pessimistic after 6 years of civil war, or is Syria really that bad? And then we will welcome back Guelph MPP and President of the Treasury Board, Liz Sandals, to the show. We'll hear about the latest news coming out of Queen's Park and what we can expect when the legislator sits again in the fall. And we've got our fingers crossed for maybe some scoops. We will see. I hope she wasn't listening because she's probably driving the other way right now. but first, we're going to look at the federal scene again and the NDP leadership race, which is still chugging along, albeit quietly, even in the midst of summer. And it looks like Ontario's most stylish MPP, Liz Sandals' colleague across the aisle, now has a lock on first place.
That's the story, anyway, as to whether he actually does. We're talking about Jagmeet Singh, who was the late addition to the race.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on who and what you read as to whether he's ahead. There's lots of media. He's getting a lot of coverage. I noticed the Globe and Mail seem to love Jagmeet Singh, not just in the opinion pages, but there seems to be a lot in there. He seems to have
not to mention the style pages.
The style pages, too. So that I and maybe that's a part of it. I don't know. It's been implied that that's it. But in terms of... money, at least, he's definitely ahead. I think he's somewhere in the, what is it, $350,000 range?
Yeah, $356,784.
And it would seem that, and of course, a lot is riding on how much money you can raise is significant. In fact, it sounds like that was the reason why Peter Julian gave up the race, because he couldn't raise enough money.
Yeah, because he had the endorsements. He had the most endorsements out of anyone.
Which are now to be distributed among whomever.
Yeah.
So money and endorsements are supposedly the name of the game. However, with Singh, it seems that the people that are donating to him give a lot of money as opposed to many, many small donors, which is what sounds like is going on with the other three candidates. In particular, Charlie Angus, to which another poll said in terms of the support of individual members, he has the highest. Now, it sounds like if Singh signs up enough people to join the NDP officially by the 17th?
This time next week.
Then perhaps this will change. I think it was in iPolitics, whatever, that was kind of implying that Singh had it wrapped up, but only if he signs up enough members. Now, as to whether that will happen, that remains to be seen as well, because he's, you know, in the Punjabi community and that, he's obviously very popular. And in urban areas, very popular guy, and I think people know him to see him, like you
sure.
said, style pages and all that.
Yep, yep.
But is it, you know, is that what it's going to take to be the person that's ahead? Perhaps. But I think there was that other poll came out too. I'm sure you saw it where percentage wise it was, Singh was on the bottom,
mm-hmm.
but Angus was on the top, followed by Ashton. And then Caron, and then Singh. It just in terms of percentage of support. I guess it depends what poll you're looking at. You know, there's the money poll,
well, there's
and there's the people poll.
The general sort of, I guess there's the general public polls in which he leads.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the NDP sort of internal polls of just members in which Angus and Ashton are kind of, they're not tied for first place, but there's a couple of percentage points between them. But I mean, for statistically speaking, they're basically tied.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what it says is there's still a large swath of NDP people who are undecided. And it's because if you watch the debates, it's not like watching the conservative debates where there was, you know, there was like red right wing blue right wing people, and then there was sort of the centrist people, and there were people like Kevin O'Leary, Rick Peterson, who are kind of the Mavericks, not from the political class. You have people like Michael Chong, who were the Red Tories, Lisa Raitt to an extent. There was a very eclectic field of various conservative philosophies. And when you watch an NDP debate, it's like, well, I think we should do more for our indigenous communities. And the other three go, I agree.
Me too, yeah.
See that. And that's why I when you interviewed Karan, I said, ask him, like, what would make the others a good leader and what would make him a good leader. And I did the same with Ashton and Julian. Because I think if you're just sort of doing a cursory glance at it, it's like, well, I guess any one of them can be leader of the NDP, but you do want to get into like kind of the nuances. So, which is why I started asking the question.
It's a great question.
You know, what makes you the best leader? What makes the others the best leader? And it's kind of hard to do that in a soundbite. To you know, and especially when you see it. And although I will give the NDP debates credit, they can actually get into things a bit more. There's actually time to get into things a bit more, even with the debate setups are basically the same with minute long answers, 30-second rebuttals. But you know, there's more.
Which is almost not enough time. Really.
Well, I mean, at the same time, though, there's more to crunch. You know, it took, you know, some rounds of a conservative debate. It took like 15, 20 minutes to get through a question in a 90-minute debate. That's, you know, maybe you get four or five questions. It doesn't quite work.
People dozing off when it gets to that point, right? But I guess if it's rapid fire, it's better. At least this most recent debate, this was in Victoria, they seem to cover a lot of ground. And unfortunately, Charlie Angus was unable to attend because his sister is ill. Well, I wouldn't say she's unwell. She's palliative, so it sounds like she's not going to make it. Speaking of endorsements, did you see the Phil Ault, friend of the show, endorsed Charlie Angus? I didn't know that people at municipal level did that, but I guess you take an endorsement where you can get it. So
I did not see that, but it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me.
Came up on my feed. I was like, hey, Phil Ault endorses Charlie Angus. Yeah, that's not
because
the thing was at his house. It's like, you know, there's obviously there's an in there. So I'm just wondering if other NDP people in town will endorse others or not.
Well, that's what it may come down to is sort of the party favor and perhaps who do you know and who do they endorse? Phil carries a lot of weight with, I think, local NDPers. He ran twice.
Mm-hmm.
He's
a name, I guess.
Yeah, he's on city council, so his opinion means a lot.
Sure.
So I think that's what it might come down to is how this will shake out locally, which is why the Jagmeet Singh frontrunner status is so curious, because you're right, he does have a lot of fans in the Punjabi community, and that is going to be key if you want to win places like Mississauga, Brampton, the fruit basket that is Ontario and the ridings there. Where it's going to get into trouble, and this was kind of buried in some of those Grenier, maybe not really buried, but certainly in terms of the enthusiasm, the undercurrent is that in Quebec, it's going to be harder. And if you remember the last election, I'm not sure what the political calculus for the NDP going into 2019 is going to be. But in 2015, it was, we got this base in Quebec. We are going to build upon it and then sweep outward from Quebec into other places. Is that going to be their strategy? Like, they think they can get back that ground in Quebec? I don't know. It's going to be harder with Jagmeet Singh. And unfortunately, this gets into kind of dirty territory in terms of like alt-right stuff. He's gonna instantly be a poster child for these alt-righters, the Proud Boys and such, about, you know, the Browning of Canada, and I hate that term, but I mean that's where they're gonna go with it. So he's gonna be battling a war on two fronts, if not three or four fronts. It's sad that he would have to deal with that, but just going by the cold hard numbers, 36% of Quebecers said they would vote for someone in a religious headdress. 36%.
And this is the only province that did the shutdown on religious headgear or tried to.
Well, that's it, exactly. And some of that will surely be racism, but some of it is just generally, you know, French anxiety about religion.
But I bet you that number probably matches up with people who would vote NDP or Quebec Solidaire, or, you know, I bet there's a parallel to that probably. That was all of Quebec. That wasn't just NDP people, was it?
I believe that was all of Quebec.
It was all of Quebec. And this is going to be the biggest challenge, I think, for the NDP, is regardless who gets the job, is the kind of regionalism that they're working with. Obviously, Caron, if elected, would do really well in Quebec and probably in some other places, but not necessarily out in the West where, you know, Alberta and Saskatchewan don't necessarily like, let's say, politicians from Quebec in general.
Cosmopolitan bias.
Yeah. We've got Nikki Ashton to the, well, Churchill. She is bilingual, so I think she would do okay in that respect. But I think
she probably also has some clout as someone from the prairies.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And the working class, I would say.
Yeah.
But in her case, it's, and that's exactly in her case, I think she's seen as the left candidate of this group in terms of the furthest left, let's say, compared to, say, Angus.
But that's not her claim, though. Her claim is, I'm a millennial, yo! And that's
also Singh can claim that, too.
Yeah, that's Jagmeet's beat as well.
This will be the thing with Trudeau. It's like he can't play the young card anymore because he is almost 50, right? So then there'll be some other people in the game. How old is Andrew Scheer? I'm just curious. Like, he's...
I don't want to. I can't say.
He's younger than Trudeau, right? Because I think he made that wisecrack.
A little bit younger.
The comment, not really a wisecrack. He made the comments like, as a young man or something. It was actually pretty funny when he said it.
He's not that
much. As a young man, no. It's in relative terms.
He was born in 79.
Oh, geez. Wow.
So he's 30. He's 38. His first birthday was in May. So he is 38.
I was going to make the Never Kiss to Grow.
So Trudeau's officially the old man of the race. If Jagmeet Singh becomes the NDP leader,
mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's another big barrier. It's just purely logistical. It's that Jagmeet Singh doesn't have a seat in the House of Commons, so would have to wait for a by-election. Although there was another by-election announced today in Quebec, but coming up this fall. But so it's not implausible.
No, would have to be Ontario.
But, well, it would have to be somewhere. Yeah. You know, he could.
Or you just sit in the rafters.
I mean, unless it's going to be one of those situations where you're going to have a party leader.
Did that not happen with Layton for a while? Wasn't
I think so.
Yeah, that's right. Because he left Toronto.
Because he was in Toronto Council.
That's right.
But, you know, you read a lot of the information, like a lot of the pressers and the fundraising emails from the NDP, and it's like, we're going to get ready for 2019. We're going to kick Trudeau, that lion, such and such, out of office. And it's like, well, that's going to be an incredibly difficult battle when you elect your leader in October, the end of October.
Yep.
And then they have to wait for a by-election, and then they have to win that by-election. So you're probably getting into spring 2018 by the time they're actually in the House. You know, that may be a bit late, but, you know, and then that's a year and a half till election time. It's not even a year and a half till election time. So, that's going to be incredibly tough for that, for Jagmeet Singh. And this is nothing against him. I'm just saying, like, pure schedule wise,
running on the numbers,
he has to make his clams in the House as the opposition leader, while also rallying the party. And he's going to have to overcome the things, the racism and the religious headgear stuff. And then within like maybe 15, 16 months, be ready to run. And then on top of that is the expectation that they're going to pick up a bunch of disenfranchised Trudeau people who are not going to, you know, that's a lot to put on his shoulders first time out.
Yeah, and that'll be the main things will be no seat and French not as good as Caron or Ashton. And sticking with that for a minute, in terms of the wildcard assessment is who will get the job. Two of them were at Vancouver Pride. Some of the listeners will probably recall that Justin Trudeau, I think it was on the first day when the election was announced, was at Vancouver Pride before his election. And there seems to be this, and there's lots of photos made the rounds of him doing his Pride parade. He was the first, I guess, prime minister to go to Vancouver Pride, or
sounds right.
he's been to lots of them since. But so Ashton and Caron, who I think were probably in that neck of the woods campaigning, were there. So if you want to go by Vancouver Pride, then it's going to be either one of those two, the leader of the NDP. No, I'm just saying, I don't know for sure. But Trudeau took a pass this year, and depending on what you read, it was either he was either vacationing with his family or was meeting with Indigenous leaders. I don't know. But, I mean, those are radically different reports. So it doesn't actually matter what Trudeau is doing. We're supposed to be talking about the NDP. So I don't know if that's sort of like the octopus that picked the soccer team that was going to win. Will Vancouver Pride decide who becomes the NDP? Adam's just shaking his head. He's like, what is he talking about? I don't know. It's like, because it could come down to that, just kind of a wild card thing. Like,
I remember the octopus. Got it.
Yeah, no, Paul the Octopus picked the team, so it's like...
Well, look, I look at it this way, too. Nobody thought Andrew Scheer was going to be conservative.
That was definitely a Paul the Octopus pick, I think. It's always going to be Scheer.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's going to be tricky because I do wonder if how many new people Jagmeet Singh brings in.
Mm-hmm. It may make a huge difference if all, you know.
And if he brings in a lot of new people based on, like, his youthfulness and charisma and, like, I'm a millennial and, like, just the fact that I'm a Sikh man running for federal leadership, you know, the very image promotes change.
A progressive Sikh man, too. I mean, it's...
Exactly. Yeah. And then what happens when Charlie Angus wins or Guy Carroll wins or even Nicky Ashton wins? Is that going to, like... deflate some of that renewed enthusiasm?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they're looking for the adrenaline shot, really.
Yes,
they want
exactly.
the injection of somebody to sort of kick it into full gear, something different from Trudeau, but yet youthful and all those things.
They want the good parts of Trudeau.
They want the good parts of Trudeau. And
without the
all the pride parades, just amp it right up.
Yeah.
Will that happen? The only thing I was thinking of, too, is that, unfortunately, we were talking about Singh in certain areas. I think a lot of people, and even though it is 2017, will have a problem with Nicky Ashton being a new mother as...
Oh,
as
no doubt.
Not,
no
I don't
doubt.
Say a problem in terms of, like, that's terrible, but they'll say, oh, no, she's going to be busy with the kid. She can't lead the party.
Oh, yeah.
I know that's going to come up at some point.
There
I mean,
will
I brought
that,
it up now. But,
that,
yeah.
There will be that maternal bias.
Which
like,
is
you can't
garbage,
be a mom and a federal leader at the same
which
time.
Is completely ridiculous, but I'm just pointing out that somebody's going to say, wow, she's going to be busy. So.
Yeah, exactly.
So people have all kinds of ridiculous reasons for choosing.
There's a lot of nutty biases. And
yeah. Choose good reasons for choosing your leader, not bad ones for not choosing another one, right?
Well exactly. And the thing with the headdress, religious headdress, it's only 56% of people across the country that have a problem. So, I mean, even that's an uphill climb.
In 2017, yeah.
So, yeah, it's 2017. I mean, 56, yeah, it's in the right direction, but, I mean, that's still really low considering the year and considering how many Sikh people are in Canada, how many people you run into on a daily basis. And it's even in some place like Guelph. People
been
who are
here
in
well
religious
over
headdress.
100 years as a community, and yet somehow it's like, well,
exactly.
Anyway, remains to be seen.
Well, these are trifles when compared to what's going on in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some hope lately because there has been a ceasefire in the southwest area of the country, although that's not the most violent area of the country. It does suggest that there is some maybe war exhaustion in Syria, at least for all the forces that aren't the government. But a woman named Carla DuPont, who's part of the UN panel who's investigating war crimes or human rights abuses, I guess they're the same thing, in Syria, for the last 5 years has said that, and this was in a Telegraph article, that everyone in Syria is bad now. Having this, a panel investigating these crimes does, in her words, absolutely nothing. They've been running up against walls for 5 years, she said, basically because it's way too violent for them to get into the country, so they can't really collect evidence. And when they do put together a report with through interviews and documentation and medical records, it hits a wall because it goes to the Security Council. And who has a seat in the Security Council but the Russians, who immediately veto anything that is meant to sanction the government forces, who are, by and large, the biggest authors of human rights abuses in Syria right now. So, I mean, that's if we're hoping that at some point soon there may be a breakthrough in terms of peace in Syria, this certainly says that no matter who wins in that civil war, it's going to be end up being a loss anyway.
Yeah,
I mean,
people
who live there.
Yeah, and quagmire is the cliche, but that's exactly what's going on. And initially, when you sent the article around, rather than Googling up everyone in Syria is bad now, I Googled no good guys in Syria almost by mistake. I was just thinking, you know, good guys, bad guys. 1.32 million hits about the good guys, bad guys in Syria because no one really knows, right? You've got so many parties involved. We've talked about this on the show before. Not only do you have the major players like the Turks and US, Russia and Britain and Iran, there's also the insurgents. And which of those insurgents are jihadis? And then you've got the Iraqis pounding into the north there. And that was one of the things that I came across. There's a, what do they call this? There was a policeman, they called him like Dr. Slaughter or something, who was just going in and taking out as many ISIS people as possible, and there's pictures of them on Facebook with guys' heads, and that's a war crime. It doesn't matter whether you like ISIS or not. Nobody likes ISIS, right? Nobody. Almost nobody.
Everyone can agree they hate ISIS.
And yet, you know, it's like, well, we're waging jihad on them. It's like, are you any better, really, if you're doing this to this community? They're terrible people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it's like, so where's the line drawn? And so when she says there are no good guys, it's true. And all this committee has been doing, as you said, the... it sounds like the Russians, for the most part, are rendering them powerless with their veto power in the UN Security Council, which I don't think is ever going. That's the way it's been since the UN was formed, right? You've got the rotating people, and then you've got the core players, anybody with a nuke, pretty much.
Well, the original five with nukes.
But she's been on other committees that actually did. They brought Milosevic to trial from former Yugoslavia, and I think initially she's involved with the Rwandan, getting people charged and convicted and saying, you committed war crimes.
She's not a noob.
No, this is the person you want on this committee. But she said, or it was said that they did something like 12 or 13 reports, and they just keep doing reports, and they have all this evidence, and they can't act on it because they haven't been empowered. No one's been giving the blessing for, I guess it would be under the world court to be able to do anything. It's just so it's just sort of like everybody just keeps doing what they're doing. They'll bomb this and bomb that, and it's like, who pays? It's always the civilians. Always.
Yeah, and I mean, the government there needs to be taken in, the Bashar al-Assad government, because in so much as, and I hate to give him credit for anything, this ceasefire that Putin and Trump worked out has been holding for the most part. This was back in July at the G8 meeting. They reached this agreement. Mm-hmm. So, it's been kind of going on a month now, or at least a couple of weeks, which is huge when it comes to Syria. But who is it that's testing the limits of this? They've enacted these zones, around sort of major cities where, mm-hmm. Have been bombarded and shelled out, and these de-escalation zones are called. But who has been testing the de-escalation zones? It's not the Russians. It's not the Turks. It's not, the Kurds or any of the parts. It's Bashar al-Assad's government. Mm-hmm. There have been three incidents sort of in the last week, including one yesterday where they start shelling in the general vicinity of these de-escalation areas, and it's only a matter of time before people get fed up of being shelled by the government and decide to shell back, and then we're back to square one. And even if all the other parties fighting Bashar al-Assad are terrible, there's at least some understanding that, maybe we need to stop if observing the ceasefire, let's stop before all our cities are just basically blown to Lego blocks. Mm-hmm. And it's Bashar al-Assad who's like, I see an opportunity here to finish the job. I'm not sure why my Bashar al-Assad is speaking with a French accent, but it's just, there is someone who is slightly more at fault than anyone else for this situation. And indeed, it was him that escalated it in the first place, because it was this. Remember way back 2011, this was one of the Arab Spring sort of uprisings, a populist uprising, and then he starts squashing it underfoot, and here we are, 6 years later, 7 years later.
Yeah, it's like a whole pile of uprisings. I believe it started with students, and then the students were arrested, and it snowballed from there, and now we're here. Of course, the ceasefire doesn't apply to ISIS.
No.
ISIS is the exception, and that's in the, I guess, mostly to the east now. There's obviously ISIS insurgents everywhere, but to the east is the major battle. It was a lot, Mosul, and Mosul was the most recent sort of liberation city, which also killed thousands of people by the sounds of it. They still don't know, and this is the problem, is that they can't get in there to see what's actually going on. And a lot of the free Syrian army is made up of a coalition, like a coalition that you couldn't dream of groups, left, right, center, jihadi, Islamist, moderate Islamist, anarchists, you name it. So it's like, it's hard to say where that's going to go, because usually when people are involved with something like that, they eventually want something. And this is what we've seen with jihadists in the past. Al-Qaeda is a good example, and even ISIS, where it's like, you feed them this, we want you to fight them, here are some weapons, here's this and that.
Yeah.
And then all hell breaks loose regularly. And when you've got so many like micro groups almost, I don't know how that's ever going to... I don't know how it's ever going to not just resolve itself. But
then
how,
you have,
how
will you know, you have sort of state-sponsored actors. And this was, like, apparently a hiccup in the ceasefire negotiations. You had Israel trying to get involved because try to stop a ceasefire because Hezbollah's got their fingers in Syria. And Iran's got their fingers in Syria. And, you know, those are two groups Israel's not a fan of. Even though, again, they all hate ISIS, and I was reading I think it was an op-ed in the Herald, which is a New Zealand newspaper, and it said, like, basically what people have to decide is it situation again about beating ISIS, or is it about getting rid of Bashar al-Assad? Because the question is, can you do both? And I think so far they've been trying to do both, but in trying to sort of, if not trying to do beat Bashar al-Assad, to try to contain Bashar al-Assad. And that you can't really do that when you have one person standing in the way, which is Russia. And they're deeply invested. I mean, after 6-7 years of war, they're still deeply invested in making sure he still stays in power.
And that's the thing. I mean, I think the only thing that will change it up to any degree is that if al-Assad is removed, like they did with an example is Idi Amin in the 70s, where he was just kind of removed from his position after years of similar things going on, sent him to Paris or Moscow or wherever with Assad. It'll be Moscow, probably set him up in an apartment so he can live out his days. He's removed from the situation. And then, or as you know, as they talked about with Hussein, surgical removal.
Right.
So if he is one of the main problems and he's removed from the situation, you know, are his generals, etc., really reflecting him, or is it a bigger picture? Along the lines of Kim Jong Un as well. Is it one person?
Yeah.
Or is it like institutionalized this their philosophy?
And so, that's the other thing too, is that now all attention is over in the Pacific because Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump are in a pissing match about who can have the hottest rhetoric while talking about nuclear war. And
which is never good. No, it's
bold,
like...
Bold stance, Scotty.
Yeah. I'm Scotty Hertz, and I'm here to tell you it's never good. Yeah,
but no, you're right.
It's
but
getting
you're right,
hot.
Though. It's but
it's a distraction too from the things like Syria. That's why we need to talk about them.
It's an existential threat, and this is kind of very particular because it's about trying to surgically take out all these forces that are causing the friction, and it's not entirely Bashar al-Assad. There are a lot of groups who we probably aren't looking forward to seeing rule Syria either, but it's a very complex problem. It's like pulling on a thread and taking the whole sweater apart. But again, when your focus is being drawn between that and Iraq and now North Korea and the Pacific Rim is like super hot and more immediate, it makes it that much trickier.
I certainly hope we're not sitting here 2 years from now discussing the exact same thing. But it's already been at least 2 years, probably more.
Sure.
We've been talking about this since the beginning.
It seems like we talk about this like once every quarter.
6 month revisit. Yeah, it's never good.
I mean, I remember talking about it on the ballot box. So it's, we're going to, we're going to keep talking about it. But we're going to talk about taking a break now and play some music. And we're going to have a special tribute for our music selection this week with a Canadian touch. But we're going to play some ads first, and then we'll come back with our guest, Liz Sandals, Guelph MPP. You are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
That was a duet from the 1970s, the late Glenn Campbell and Anne Murray, who were just talking about what happened to Anne Murray. If you know, let us know. 519, no, don't call
Anne Murray, if you're listening, send us a communique.
Yes, Anne, we'd love to have you on. And that was another 70s classic, United We Stand. That was
it's from the album creatively named Anne Murray / Glenn Campbell.
Available on Spotify, it seems.
It is available on Spotify. They reissued it last year, and it was originally released in 1971.
So you can tell we're huge fans, right?
I think what we're demonstrating is the 3 minutes of research into the music for this show that we did at roughly 4:54.
You're revealing our secrets, Adam. You got to keep them guessing.
But did you find the Anne Murray Children's one?
Oh, yeah, that I'm a hippo in the tub.
Yeah, the hippo in the tub. Yes. I mean, that's the all-time favorite at my house is the hippo in the tub.
Okay.
You can tell I have children.
Oh, I was going to say, is that when the children are over, or is that just any time?
No, that was when my kids were little. I mean, you are going back here to the 70s and 80s. So
the next time Liz is on, we got to get that album
right.
And then
we got to get out the kids' music next time Liz is on. Anyway, yes, that is Liz Sandals, Guelph MPP, and... You switched cabinet position since you were last on. You're now president of the Treasury Board.
I am president of the Treasury Board, alternately known as Dr. No.
Dr.
Show me the money. It's, no.
Is that what they say behind your back and you're not supposed to know?
No, they're quite upfront about
it. Or it's like, Dr. No, what about this? That's interesting.
People say, what does the president of Treasury Board do? And any money that is being spent essentially comes through Treasury Board. So not everybody gets to spend all the money that they want to spend. Mm-hmm. Hence the Dr. No.
Interesting. But the government has been spending a lot of money lately in terms of new programs and things. And we're getting a little deeper into issues than right off the bat, and I want to talk to you. But since you opened the door, I did want to ask about guaranteed basic income, because I know that was kind of a big deal. A lot of people have been asking for that.
It's been really interesting. And we agreed that we would do a pilot. Mm-hmm. We wanted to do a pilot that would be valid, and so that we would have some urban, some sort of smaller cities, rural, northern. So one of the pilots is in the Hamilton-Brantford area, which gets us various urban size, and southern Ontario rural. Also in the Lindsay area, so that gets us a little bit more town, eastern rural, and up in Thunder Bay, so that we get the northern city, northern rural, which is obviously different than farm country outside Brantford.
Right.
So what the stage that we're at right now is trying to get a true random sample of low-income people to participate. And so that's taking, I think it would be fair to say that that's taking a little bit longer than maybe we anticipated. To get the sample. Because when you send things out randomly, of course, lots of people aren't low income.
Right.
So that's the first screen. But then the second thing is we want there to be full disclosure that if you go on the guaranteed income, that it's for a period of a few years, and this isn't a lifetime guaranteed income because it's a pilot program.
Right.
So I think we're seeing a little bit more interest. One of the things that we have at Treasury Board is a behavioral insight unit. Mm-hmm. So that the behavioral insight unit that's in my ministry is actually working with the community and social service people that are running the pilot now and trying to see if we can design the materials so we get a better response of people coming in to find out, do I want to participate?
So not the FBI agents that catch serial killers. This is a different... I'm just trying to inject some humor into the proceedings. Sometimes I fail.
So anyway, I'm quite interested in seeing how this works, because we want a true mix of people, because when you think about low income, we often think about people that are on social assistance of one form or another, but you've also got a lot of working poor. Some of the people that are in social assistance, they may be there if it's Ontario Disability Support because they've got a developmental issue or a mental health issue. And there's a bit of a sense that some people may be suited to a guaranteed annual income, because this assumes that we're going to give you sort of a living wage and then you will manage everything. And if you've got an adult with a developmental delay, they actually need the support that goes with the social assistance program, the help in managing. So there's a sense of we need to also find out, does this facilitate people moving out of social assistance? Does it facilitate mom being able to maybe get childcare and get a bit of education and get back to work? Does it create more mobility? Or who's the people that it actually doesn't work for, that they actually need a combination of, they actually need the counseling and the caseworker support as well as the financial support. So it's really interesting. We've brought in some university researchers to help us with the design to make sure that the results are actually valid.
Mm-hmm. And on top of that, and it's kind of interesting, the two things are happening at once, is going to a $15 minimum wage, because we're, you know, you're talking about sort of the two solutions that anti-poverty activists are saying we need to make it a living wage for the minimum wage, plus make sure that people can make enough money. Has there been any discussion yet on how those two might overlap?
No, because we haven't seen the research data yet.
Okay.
So I think, first of all, we need to figure out what the research tells us, and then we need to figure out how do we use that information to implement sensible programs.
Okay.
But you're right, the whole discussion around minimum wage is really interesting, because what seems to have happened post-recession is that the distribution of income is different than it classically was. So it's still true that about 10% of people are actually on minimum wage, but it's also true post-recession that about 3 out of 10 workers are earning less than $15, what we're proposing is the minimum wage. So that's 30% of people who are working making below a living wage. And we didn't used to see the workforce so dramatically divided into low income, because clearly anybody below $15 an hour is very definitely below living wage, low income. And then this other group of people who are upper middle class, higher income, who are doing fine. And it's like the in between, the sort of lower middle class in particular, seems to have sort of dropped out of that wage continuum. So part of what we're real, and then who is low income has changed.
Right.
So it used to be that the assumption was that the people that were working at minimum wage was students.
Yeah.
It was people that were on their first time job. So maybe you just graduated from post-secondary and it was your first job. And yeah, it was low income, but you weren't going to be there long.
Right.
If you look at who's on minimum wage now, or at least who's in that under $15 an hour group, over half of them are 25 to 64-year-olds. So over half of the people that are below living wage are actually the people who should be in their prime earning years.
Right.
And that's different from what we used to see. And then maybe not surprisingly, the majority of people that are in that low-income category are women and immigrants.
Yeah.
So it's the perception that, oh, well, it's just the students and the first time job people is no longer true.
No, and that's very true. And for some people, too, it's, you know, there are people who work two jobs and they're both sort of within the similar same service sector. And I wonder about this, too, because I'm looking for a day job at the moment. So I'm scanning the want ads. But I kind of see the same sort of general business things pop up on the job boards, and they are those service sector jobs as well. And I'm wondering, just to myself, and maybe you have some thoughts too, but I know that a lot of this discussion has been how this is going to affect employers. But I also wonder too if this doesn't help employers as well to maybe incentivize people to take those jobs because they'll make a little bit more money at it with a $15 minimum wage, because a lot of it's just economics. Well, am I going to work at Walmart for $11 an hour, or am I going to work at Linamar for, you know, $17-$18 an hour as a starting salary?
And one of the things that we hear from employers is that they have trouble finding workers, and yeah, particularly in those job categories that are less attractive.
Right.
It's difficult to attract and retain people to work. And obviously, people who have a bit better income, a bit more stability, are more likely to stay a little bit more consistently in some of those particularly service sector jobs. And, I mean, the reality is that the job mix is changing too.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have a lot of jobs that require a lot of education, but you do have the jobs that don't require a lot of education, mm-hmm, do tend now to be service sector jobs, where it used to be maybe you left high school and you got a job in a factory and it turned out to be a pretty good unionized job. And
yeah,
the people that were depending on manufacturing, low skills manufacturing, mm-hmm, are the people that went south of the border in search of low wages.
Right.
The people that are still in manufacturing in Ontario are the people who have updated their lines, the line is more mechanized, the skills that a lot of the workers need are now directed at designing and maintaining the line,
right,
as opposed to being the line, as it were, the production line. So what's available in the job market has changed, and we need to think about how do we handle this sort of... We know that the good-paying jobs require post-secondary education, but there is this group of lower-skilled jobs, which are service sector jobs.
Yeah, we hear a lot about income inequality, but it's almost like there's skills inequality as
exactly.
well now. There's jobs that in the service sector that you can jump in, but they don't pay very well. Meanwhile, the jobs that pay really well, you need some kind of advanced training.
That's very much true. I mean, I've looked. Obviously, you get the Sunshine List every April, and everybody, you know, tries to rake through the entrails of the Sunshine List to figure out what they can.
That's how Scotty spent his Saturday.
Cover to cover,
and it's getting
days
thicker
later.
And thicker,
I'm like, oh
thicker.
My god!
I mean, that could keep you going all summer.
I think so,
it could
yeah.
be your summer reading.
Don't print it because it'll be a whole tree worth of.
Well, yeah. Actually, we do post it on the internet mm-hmm. now, so you can go and read it. You can read it online. You don't need
sure.
to waste paper. No forests need to die. But what I was going to say is the skills gap is really interesting, because if you look at people will say, oh, well, all those people at OPG, Ontario Power Generation, yeah. are really well paid. But if you look at the really well paid people, they are clearly in categories that are technical. You can tell by the job title that they're engineers, they're nuclear technicians. They probably, a lot of them have PhDs in physics.
Yeah, they have an alphabet soup after
their
names.
They've got an alphabet soup, and they've got, or, you know, they may just be really highly skilled electrical workers, or
right.
they may be, you know, keeping all the steam fittings and things that you've got in a nuclear plant. But they are all really technical classes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at that group of workers, they're really well paid, but it's also because they're very highly skilled.
Yeah.
And there's quite a gap then between those workers and some of the other public sector workers who may not have as much skills training. But it's related to how marketable is this skill.
Mm-hmm. So how do we close that gap? I mean, I know there's been changes to tuition for post-secondary that make it a bit more affordable. But, I mean, people are needing jobs today. Employers are needing people with those skills.
Well, that's not just magically going to appear.
No, of course.
So, and of course, being a university community here that we're talking to, people would be aware that we're changing the OSAP program significantly. Mm-hmm. And what led us to do that was the fact that when you looked at the data, you found that a student from a high-income family was four times as likely to go to post-sec as a student from a low-income family. And we don't think that family income should be the determinant. It should be, do you have the qualifications mm-hmm. and talent to go to post-sec? So we've stood SAP on its head, and there will be more support to get students from lower income families, obviously, who have the skills. You still have to qualify to get in.
Yeah.
But if you can qualify to get in, you should be able to find a place in post-secondary education to get the training to get you out of the low income category.
Mm-hmm. I do want to look forward a bit, but I do want to get this obvious, the most obvious question out of the way first. Are you planning on running next year?
I'm still mulling this over. You should know by now, Adam, that I don't necessarily announce these things early.
Slide Adam a $5 bill there.
We were joking before the show. It's like, is there a way we can like sort of get like surprise you and just like try and jump scare you and admit yes, and but you're too shrewd. So that's I'll accept the answer, but it's you're not ruling. I mean, they say in politics, you know, you never say no. Every answer is a yes until you say no. But yeah, so there you go. In terms, you know, whether you're running or not, there is an election coming up, and I know this is probably going to be a pretty tough one for your party. Not for any specific reason, but you know, if just, you know, 15 years in power.
Yeah, and I think the toughest thing actually is that we have been here for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. When you do some of the polling and you ask specific questions about, do you like what the Liberals are doing with healthcare? Do you like the government policy on education? Do you like the government policy on post-secondary education? Do you like the government policy on transit? And if you go through it from a policy point of view, you actually get really positive responses about the vast majority of government policies. I've actually got great faith in the electorate. My observation would be, particularly as we've been around a few times, so you've got this, oh, well, we should change because we could change,
mm-hmm.
is that at the beginning of the campaign, it's about, are you mad at the government?
Mm.
And by the end of the campaign, the ballot question is switched to, who do you actually want to be the premier?
Mm.
Given the choices, who do you actually want to be the premier? And whose policies do you actually want? You know, do you want OHIP Plus? Do you want health pharmacare for everybody under 25? Do you want a revised OSAP? Do you want investments in schools and hospitals and transit? Once people sort of settle on whose policies do I like, then you often see during the campaign that things have switched around a lot. And I actually think that that's, you know, quite likely what we will see happening in 2018, because we know that when you ask the questions about policy,
mm-hmm.
that in fact people tend to be quite positive.
You're not worried about the hydro issue at all?
Oh, obviously, that's something that that people are going to talk about. But on the other hand, if you sort of think it through, do you want cheap coal, or do you want to have clean air and pay a little bit more for electricity? And interestingly, in Guelph, I will get as many comments about, oh, well, you shouldn't have lowered the price of hydro, as opposed to, why didn't you lower it more? Because people actually are thinking about, well, we need to get better at conserving energy.
Right.
We need to make those changes so that we're going to energy sources that aren't based on carbon. So we get, it's interesting the variety of takes that people have on on hydro.
It's a deeply personal issue, and you know, just speaking from my own example, I realize anecdotal evidence isn't necessarily, you know, clear evidence, but my hydro bill went down last year, and that's because speaking to that conservation. We're having a conversation about conservation. There we go. And my neighbor, though, will have her house shut up all year, you know, having the heat. She'll have the heat on, but from October to April, and then have the air conditioning on from April to October, whether, you know, no matter what it is outside, what it's like outside.
Well, when people call the constituency office and they talk about up and down, one of the first things we'll often say to them is, do you save your bills? And let's compare that to how much you know, it went up so much over last month. Well, let's look at your consumption this year, this month compared to last month. Well, I'm paying more this summer than I paid last summer. Well, let's look at your consumption this summer compared to your consumption last summer.
Right.
And when you sort of talk through the hydro bill in terms of consumption, then people will often go, oh, yeah, I did use more. So, but people, you know, hydro bills are impossibly complicated to read.
Yes.
So you almost need an instruction manual. In fact, that's one of the things that we've told the Minister of Energy is we want to work on a simplified hydro bill so that people can actually understand what it is they're paying for.
And it's so hard to do that one-on-one as well. You know, when you're talking about a province of 10, 11, 12 million people, to say, you know, go one-on-one to work with everyone and say, let's lower your hydro bill through conservation. It's, I mean, that's tough.
Yeah, and but a lot of people really have made changes in the way that they've turned up the thermostat or a couple of notches in the summer so they're not air conditioning quite as much, or put on an extra sweater in the winter, so that people really have made some changes. And that's great, because then we come to the other discussion, which is around cap and trade, and that we need to get, in terms of future reduction on greenhouse gases, we're going to need to do that more through transit and buildings, making buildings more efficient, because other than the industrial, the things that you and I can control have more to do with buildings and how we get around.
Very true. Very true. Are you running? I'm just...
I'm not sure.
How about Twitter? Can we get you on Twitter?
No.
No.
I had to try. Anyway.
First of all, you have to convince me to use it.
Well.
I keep telling people that Donald Trump is the perfect example of why Twitter is bad for politicians.
And well, we can't argue with you
no.
there.
Although we both follow him, of course.
We have
a little,
to.
A little too closely, I think. Mm. Anyway, Liz, thank you so much for coming in and talking
You're
to us today.
Welcome.
And we're glad you were able to get an escort through the
construction
construction zone here on the second floor. So
I may need to get an escort to find my way out.
We'll see what we can do. That's it for this week's show. Unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. It's almost 6 o'clock, and our next special guest will be on August the 24th. We will have Marwan Tabara, MP of Kitchener South Hespeler. He will be on the show, and we'll have more special guest announcements soon as we go into the fall. That will be on our website, opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on the Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And you can listen to past episodes of Open Sources on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. And you can find me back here next Thursday at 10 for the End Credits radio show about movie news and reviews. And on Twitter, I can be found at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter. Scotty Hertz on Facebook. And I blog at a place called The Spanner Books, spannerbook.wordpress.com.
Yeah, well, now that we've done hassling Liz Sandals about Twitter, we can just say that stay tuned for more Prisoners Justice Day coverage here on CFRU. There will be another program with that theme here at the top of the hour. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m.